Hi, I'm Skating PJ, and this is Let's Talk About It, the Skate Ontario podcast, where we're going to get up close and personal with members of our skating family who have a connection to Ontario. So, let's talk about it. Hi, everybody. At Skating PJ here with another amazing episode of the Let's Talk About It podcast. Today, I am speaking with two-time Olympic medalist and world champion, Brian Orser. Brian Orser, there you are. How are you?
I'm very well, PJ. How are you doing?
I am swell. Thank you so much. Okay, we're going to get right into it. It's the Olympic season, and we've obviously got Ontario athletes that are going to the Olympic Games, although we don't know who yet, because we're taping this way before any of that's happening. So we're at the start of another season. Talk to me about one of your two Olympic seasons and what the preparation was like.
Oh, my gosh. You know, the preparation for the Olympic season, more in 88, it started like the day after the World Championships in 87. So that would be in Cincinnati. And I had won those that World Championship. And my preparation started literally the next day. 84 was a little bit different. I was kind of a little bit kind of green, I guess, although I was third in the world. I don't know. I just kind of rolled with it a bit more. But in 88, it was kind of a, you know, the Olympics were in Canada. And so then I had some like sponsor opportunities. And so it just became bigger and a lot more intense. But I mean, I handled it. And you know, you live and breathe Olympics for the whole season. All of these Olympic athletes, potential Ontario athletes, are thinking Olympics right now, for sure, 100%.
Absolutely. What did you think about, I mean, obviously, you know, you're a kid way back then, 1984 and 1988. Did you really understand the magnitude of the Olympic Games? Like, did it change for you the significance of it as you sort of moved through your coaching? Of course, coaching two different Olympic champions, Yuzuru Hanyu and Yuna Kim. Did it change? Like, did your focus change or your perspective?
You know, I always had this thing about the Olympics starting at a very young age. And I remember at school, all the way through academically, any chance I could do any kind of project on the Olympics, I would. So if it was health and fitness, I would obviously do something about the Olympics and some statistics and, you know, some pick a sport kind of thing. And then, you know, I would do geography. Hey, I could do a thing about the Olympics and where they were. And then history, I would do a whole history class on the Olympics and the history of the Olympics. So I always found an excuse to do something with the Olympics. And then all of a sudden in 1980, it was my first year as a senior competitor domestically. And kind of went, oh, geez, it's an Olympic year. I kind of have a little bit of an off chance. It didn't happen. I came fourth. But I went to the Olympics in Lake Placid to watch. I went with my dad, and it was a drive. And we went there as a guest of Coca-Cola, because my dad was involved with Coca-Cola. So we went, and that was my first time seeing real life, you know, Olympic stuff. And then from there, I had the bug, and I was determined to be involved as an athlete anyway.
What drew you to skating in the first place? Go take me back to little Brian.
Well, I guess like every other Canadian, I played hockey. I was from a pretty big family. We were five kids. And simply, I just couldn't skate. So my parents, my mom was the president of the local skating club up in Midland. And she, so it was kind of a natural for me just to learn how to skate through the skating club. And it was also a chance for my mom to have a break from the five of us. So we kind of all went onto the ice at the same time. And she would have an hour to sit with her friends and chit chat. And, you know, and we were somebody else's responsibility at that point. And then it just took off from there. Any chance I could skate, I would skate. So, you know, through the winters when there was a frozen puddle outside, up in Midland or Penetanguishene, I would be on it. I'd throw my skates on. If it was big enough, I could twirl.
That is unbelievable. Did you develop a love of jumping early on, or did that come later?
It was more of a sense of flying. I just loved to go fast. I remember always coming home from our, you know, whatever days we skated, and fall a lot. So my mittens would be soaking wet, and my ski pants would be soaking wet, and my sweater would be soaking wet because I did a lot of falling. But it was probably because I was going too fast, and I didn't really have any kind of foundation of any technique at all. But I certainly love to go fast, and I guess jumping was part of that as well.
You and I spoke a long time ago about figures and how figures really helped with sort of creating that control, that little micro control of muscles. Did that really contribute to your skating? I mean, your edges were just absolutely glorious. The way you could traverse the ice, still can, by the way, it just was... I mean, not in the same way exactly, but still, the foundations are there. So to what do you attribute those foundations?
I think a lot of it is compulsory figures because it's discipline. It was understanding turns and understanding how to use my body. That certainly did help. But I think the biggest thing was I used to ice dance. And I remember quite often for my own dance tests, and then I used to also partner. I learned a lot about rhythms. I learned a lot about tempos. So I knew the difference between a tango and a cha-cha and a Killian and a waltz. I mean, I learned all those things, and I would adapt to my skating. And it was actually, it was your mother that actually we used to always, every test day, she'd say, "It's not too late, Brian, to get into the ice dance. It's not too late."
I was just going to remind you.
You remember? Oh, my gosh. It was because she quite often would judge some of my dance tests, and she would judge the tests that I was partnering. And I'd always go into the room where the judges were and to get whatever feedback. And she'd be like, "It's not too late."
Do you know what? The world would have been better off either way, even if you had become a dancer with a partner. The fact that you understand music, and as a single skater, I mean, you left us with so many thrilling performances. I want to talk a little bit about the Olympic Games. Did you walk in the opening ceremony?
I did both times. Yeah, of course. And, it's something really special. There's something about just seeing the Olympic flame. And so I know in Sarajevo in 84, taking separate little trips on my own and just kind of like looking at it and just understanding the significance of it. And then in 88, I really did march on the opening because I had the honor of carrying the Canadian flag into the opening. So that was pretty incredible.
I remember, there were still pictures of you the next day carrying the flag. I remember watching it on television. I was talking to Kurt Browning, and he was talking about the Olympic experience. I mean, it's basically the same competitors that are at the World Championships.
Sure.
However, it's a very different vibe. You know, you've got teammates who are from hockey, who are from luge, who are from everything. What are some of the broader experiences and some of the bigger lessons that the Olympic Games taught you?
Well, just exactly that, like what Kurt was talking about, what you just mentioned with it's a real test for focus because you need, as much as you do want to cheer on your teammates from other disciplines and you want to celebrate them, whether it's Gaëtan Boucher winning in 1984, some of the marquee speed skating events, that was great. And you wanted to take inspiration from those people, which I did. And then there might be an upset or disappointment with somebody else. Maybe it's a skier or whatever, or a hockey team. So then you try not to let that kind of drag you down, and you have to sort of keep your focus. You have to be selfish, which is one thing I did learn from the very beginning. I remember in 84, we did some training in Germany, and then the team took a bus to Sarajevo, and it was like a 16-hour bus ride. And I had the option, I made the option for myself to fly there and train longer in Germany. And I'd still be there in time for the opening ceremony. And I did take a lot of getting approval from the Canadian Olympic Committee, not just our figure skating team leaders, you know, Joyce Heisey and those folks and Nori Bowden, and I had to get approval. And it was right to the last second where they said, they just let me do what I felt was the right thing. So I kind of came in like 4 or 5 days later. I flew in, you know, it took just a few hours. And I got there in time for everything. And I had some extra training in Germany. But I was being selfish. I was thinking about myself. I was thinking about what was important and what I needed. And we had all our ducks in a row. We had our flights confirmed. Everything was organized. We looked at this week and we knew that the weather was going to be okay. You know, and once you're there at the games, you really have to be somewhat selfish and just focus on your own event.
Brian, do you think that, I mean, you've got a big brain, and people might not know that you are as smart as you are. Do you think that that brain helped you as an athlete and then as a coach, certainly where strategy is concerned?
I trained for everything. When I was training, there was a sense of being a somewhat selfish as far as getting my job done and people around me providing whatever I needed to get my job done, whether it was getting my music when I needed to get my music, whether it was getting the right patch for when I was doing my compulsory figures, getting people in, changing schedules in order to accommodate what I needed. And it was all for the greater good of what I needed, because that did kind of contribute to the school, and it contributed to the reputation of the Mariposa School of Skating, which is where I came from. So, just training smart. I remember filming a clean short and a clean long program, and having those on our, having a video machine ready to go when I was in Sarajevo and when I was in Calgary, to watch my programs over and over and over, because we didn't get a whole lot of practice time. So for me to get back to the village and go into a room and with the VCR and watch my program 5 or 6 times was as good as any kind of session, where anybody else could have been hanging out in the social areas of the village, which seemed every Olympic Games, they seem to be getting bigger and more grand.
Yes.
I stuck to myself and did my training that way. And that was, you know, really, really beneficial.
So that whole visualization thing really helped you.
Yes. And maybe I should have filmed some really good left forward inside rockers and forward double threes. But anyway, seemed to be all about the short and long programs, which I, you know, in Sarajevo, I won the short and long, and in Calgary, I won the short. So pretty good track record in the free skating part. And then Calgary, I was 3rd in the figures, which was pretty major, which, I mean, I worked so hard for that.
Yes, I absolutely bet you did. You know, it's interesting. I had a conversation with your former coach or old coach or whatever you want to call it, your coach Doug Lee, 100 years ago. Yes, really. Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yes, only.
So he talked to me a little bit about the challenge of trying to help you understand that one element not going as you hoped for did not mean that the whole thing was junk, that you were a bit hard on yourself and a bit perfectionistic, which of course has its own challenges in coaching. So what were the things that you learned from being able to cope with that you've passed along to students? I mean, you've got big students. Big grown-up students.
I think the only thing I could pass on, sure, there's the logistical knowledge, you know, but the one thing that I found when I was working, starting with Yuna, was that when we were getting close to the Olympics and the pressure was mounting, having somebody with you who can actually say, I know what you're going through, gives you that, it just allows you to just sort of relax, because, you know, maybe misery loves company. But what I could honestly say to her, you know, I know what you're going through. Because, you know, her mom could say that, or a judge or a federation person, or somebody can say, oh, I know what you're going through. But no, you don't. You have no clue, you know. So for me, I felt with her, there was a sense of relief that we were in this together and that I didn't know what she was going through. And then I kind of fast forward to the next two Olympic cycles, you know, with Yuzu and with Javier. I could say that to them too, when the pressure was mounting, and boy, it sure was mounting. I could just say, okay, I actually know what you're going through, and what can I do to help you? Or because I didn't have anybody there who knew what I was going through, you know?
Yes, not in that first hand. Yeah. Do you think that the Olympics bring with it more pressure in the 2020s, let's say, in the 2000s, than they did in the 1980s? Like, is it a different animal?
I think, for me, there's a lot of pressure in a different way as a coach, but I just think with each year, they get bigger because there are more sports. They're just as big on television. I guess maybe they're bigger because social media is more prevalent now and important. So, and being able to manage that. So you're not just managing yourself and your schedule and your practice sessions, but you're also managing the media and the social media. I mean, we had enough managing the actual media, but then the social media, I just don't know if I could have managed that when I was skating in 84 and 88, because I'm a bit too nosy and I care too much about what people think.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's one thing for me, which is actually, it's not really in my favor that, you know, when I would be selecting music, for instance, for a new season, and I'd be playing it at the rink, you know, maybe a little bit of choreography done, and I would kind of sense from somebody, even just a bystander, just that they were not, they're not sure if they like it or not. I would be like, oh my God. And I'd have to go back to the drawing board and have to start over again because there was one person that didn't like it. So can you imagine if I was reading social media? Well, I find myself going down the old rabbit hole, but it's—
We all do.
And it's just, you know what, not, and you can't please everybody. And I try to explain that to the skaters too. They know it better than me, to be honest with you. If I see anything negative about my skaters or about me, I take it personally.
Yeah.
And that's the way it is these days. So you have to filter through all that stuff and consider where it's coming from.
You know, Patty Cranston, whom we both know, gave me a great piece of advice once. And she said, don't believe the bad things people say about you, but don't believe the good things either. In other words, run your own race.
Run your own race. And you can manage the path and you can steer this ship. You know, that's kind of it's a Doug Lee thing, you know, just to sort of steer that ship. And it's absolutely true. Who's at the helm and who's going to be, there's a point too, as an athlete, that you start taking control. I mean, that happened with my own athletes when they were ready to take control, they took control. And you were probably witness to just seeing Yuzuru coming into a venue and getting onto a practice. It wasn't like me saying, okay, we're going to do this. And, you know, we pretty much had a good idea just from experience, but I didn't have to tell him what he was doing in his program. Like, he knew what he was doing because he knew what he needed to do.
Yes.
You know, none of these kids are lazy. So there was a reason they have experience. So they were steering the ship. And so for me, you know, every once in a while, you got to put the paddle in and just sort of guide them a little bit. That's fine.
Do you know what's so interesting about that coach-student relationship? And I'm thinking about it even as a bystander. When Yuzuru Hanyu would take the ice and there was a look in his eye, I kid you not, and the camera would come in on him close and you said, okay, he has just thrown down the gauntlet and he's basically said, championship is mine. The rest of you can have whatever else you want. But this top spot belongs to me. Could you see that as well?
Yes. I mean, he trained that way too. So that wasn't a put on your game face on the day off. This was, and this is something I learned as an athlete too. So when you are taking your opening position and you know that look that he would have in his eye, he would have it at the boards when he was talking to me. He'd have his hands up like this and he'd pound the boards and he would squeeze Pooh Bear. And then, you know, he'd slap and he'd go, you know. And that was, he did that, you know, many, many days leading up to a championship. So he practiced it here at the club and then he takes his opening position. I learned to do that too. So every run through was the real deal. Like, I would take my spot, learn to take that breath and how quickly it goes in and how quickly it goes out and how it settles, and you know, and then just feel that trickle of sweat go down, you know, and just go, okay, there it is. And then the music would start. So it wasn't just circle, take your spot and do a run through. It was like the real deal. And so they learned to do that. And it was really beneficial. But boy, that look, I wouldn't want to be competing against that.
I wouldn't either. But, you know, it's a very interesting thing when you're trying to prepare athletes for competition, I am sure. I mean, I only ever had low-level athletes, so I don't know exactly what that must be like. But you have the pressure of really trying to guide the athlete to the performance that they're going to win, right? And there's an interesting, I was speaking with another Olympian, Anastasia Buxus, who comes from speed skating, and she talked about the difference between losing and being beaten. She hated losing, but being beaten by somebody else's better performance, she could take. You know, if she tried her best and she got beaten. Is there anything to do with that philosophy? Does that ring true with you at all?
Yes. I kind of like read this in the paper, but it was like in after 88, you know, it was kind of written that. And so in 84, I won the silver.
Yep.
And then in 88, I lost the gold. So
interesting.
It was an interesting way to look at it. And it was kind of a little bit painful. And it was very accurate because I went into the 84, ranked third in the world. And then I came second and I won the short and long. So I made a big splash and that was exciting and everybody was celebrating. But then in 88, there was a little less celebration because I went in as the world champion. So I did lose the gold. So yes, I get it.
All these years later, are you able to put both those silver medals in perspective? Are they equal? Are they different? Where do you put that?
I think they're equal. I mean, emotionally, they were kind of different to accept. I mean, you look back to the podium of 84 and the podium of 88, and you know, it was emotionally different. But when now, you know, however many 35 or 40 years later, maybe 36 and 40 years later, I look at it. I'm just really incredibly proud of what I did. You know, I see some of these skaters going out there now and that door closes behind them. And I'm like, how the heck did they do this? And then I got to go, hey, I did this too.
Yes, you did. And you know, we're incredibly proud of you because, you know, people don't think necessarily when you're walking in your shoes, you don't believe that it's necessarily as big a deal as those of us looking from the outside believe it to be. Were there other things that came out of the Olympic experience? Like, what was it like? You're a member of the Order of Canada, officer, I think, right? Did I get that right?
Yes. Thank you. A lot of people don't know that.
Yes. I just
there's
wasn't...
one other skater that's an officer. I'll let you stew with that for a bit.
Who is the other skater who's the officer of the Order of Canada?
Barbara Ann Scott.
I imagine she would have been. Oh, she was a treat too. She was a big fan of yours, by the way, as you probably know.
Oh,
yeah, me too. But what about those other experiences? You know, did they do something for you? How did your parents feel about them? What was that like?
I think both Olympic experiences, 84, 88, was certainly a family affair. My folks were in a position to bring the family to Sarajevo, and so they went as a group and as a family, and kind of left me to do my thing. But it was cool to see how they were just so proud and nervous and excited and anxious and all those things that I was going through. So they were kind of digging the whole experience and they were having a blast at the same time because they were all very athletic and liked to ski and do all those things. And then in 88, they went as a guest of Coca-Cola my dad was very involved there. And so they, and then Labatt's also did a family parent sponsor thing that was really cool. So they had their uniform and they did a lot of things with other parents. So that was, and from Alta Sports. So that was cool. And then they rented a house up in Kenmore and just kind of really enjoyed the whole Olympics experience. And so it's something for them that they will always remember and cherish. And it was, you know, a big part of their lives. And we got to do it all together. Who gets to say that?
Speaking of all together, you and your cohort in crime, Tracy Wilson, have been friends for about a gazillion years. Oh, now you end up working together, and I know how important you are to each other. Does it help that she's been where you are as well in terms of that whole Olympic experience, in terms of what she can offer skaters as well? What does that partnership mean to you?
Well, there are so many things, I mean, with our Olympic experiences, you know, and she's, you know, she's a medalist in ice dance.
Yep.
So that's like a win right there. And she's also like a mom, you know, of three amazing kids. And, you know, when I'm saying to her, you know, when the skater comes in and they're a little bit late for like a session at noon, I'm like, how can you be late? She's like, Brian, I have three teenagers, you know, they probably just got out of bed. So this is how teenagers think. I just like, I don't get it. Anyway, so she keeps me grounded and reminds me of how these, you know, these kids, you know, how they can be late for a session at noon. So she keeps me grounded that way. And, you know, and it's really amazing. I was just sharing with one of my other skating moms recently that they're experiencing some really cool things with some of the friendships that you get in skating. And that, these are friendships that'll go on for your life. It could be amazing networking that you don't even know as a 17-year-old that you are networking, and that these folks and these kids and these colleagues, you are going to be crossing paths all the way through your life, hopefully, and just how much you're going to cherish this down the road. So it's such a great journey, and that's what I cherish the most, and Tracy is one of them. And here we are working together. We've been friends for, I'm guessing, almost, well, more than 45 years.
Yep, that's amazing. My last question has to do with culture. You've taught lots of different skaters from lots of different countries. Talk to me about how skating sort of overrides culture, or how skating unites everybody globally that you've worked with.
Well, you know, I don't know if you can see from here, but like, along the wall, I've got all the flags of all the countries of the kids who are usually currently here. There are some that we just can't take down. So, you know, Spain has to stay up there.
Yes.
You know, we have Japanese skaters and we have Korean skaters and we have American skaters and we have a skater from Mongolia right now, and they're from all over the planet. And that's what's really cool, that this wonderful world of skating kind of unites everybody. And we have our little safe haven here at the club where it's private and we all speak the same language, which is skating, and we all have the same love affair, which is skating. And that's what, for us, that makes our world go around. And it's kind of a really cool thing, and it's interesting with the different cultures, the way they train, and I have to adapt to the way a Japanese skater will train compared to a Spanish skater, how they train.
Or a Canadian skater.
And a Canadian skater and an American skater, and different parts of the social media and expectations, what's sort of the weight on their shoulders. So it's been a bit of a, you know, a bee's nest of really great things. And as Peter Jensen said, you know, it's great to have butterflies in your stomach as long as they all fly in formation. For the most part, all these butterflies are all flying in formation, and we're all in it for the greater good, and we're in it for the right reasons.
So the final thought is for you, and if you could offer just a piece of advice or something to that aspiring skaters might want to hear from you.
Well, if these are aspiring skaters that are getting ready for the Olympics, then this is the time that you need to be pretty, you have to be somewhat selfish. You have to think about what you need, and surround yourself with really good people that can help make this happen for you. You do somehow need to find somewhat of a balance, but that's tough. Because there's, you know, as we go through these next months, there'll be constant reminders of the Olympics. It's going to be on television. It's going to be on every TV commercial. It's going to be on every print ad. And that's what I found. You know, I went to go get gasoline at a Petro-Canada, and, you know, I would get a free cup that had the Olympic ring on it, you know, to the point where I didn't want to fill up my car anymore because I just didn't want any more reminders, you know. And then just the well-wishers, you know, go for the gold, and, you know, and it's, everybody has great intentions, and that's what you have to really, you know, remind yourself that everybody has great intentions for you, whether it's fans, family, your community, your federation, your province, everybody, they have great intentions. And so that's what you have to really step back and remember that, and take comfort in that.
Ryan Orser, thank you so much for talking to me today. I am so happy that we're part of the same skating family. Have a wonderful, wonderful season.
Thank you, PJ. It's nice talking to you as always.
You too, kiddo. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Let's Talk About It, the Skate Ontario podcast. Don't forget to follow us on social media. I'm at Skating PJ. Until next time, bye for now.